That night, when he heard her shiver, he opened a fold of his kaross, and she crept into it. Butso feigned sleep, but his body was tense, and he was aware of each tiny movement that the girl made as she settled to sleep. It would have been so easy to reach out and hold her down with his arm across her chest while he forced his knee between hers. The thought made him twitch and grunt.
"Lord," she whispered, "something troubles you."
"What is your name?" he asked for want of a reply, and found that he was whispering also.
"Tanasi."
"Tanasi." He measured it on his tongue, and it fitted well enough, although he recognized it was a Rozwi name, one of the splinter tribes of the Mashona, and he did not know the meaning.
"I know your name. Everyone speaks it with respect," she said. "Butso, the axe."
"I killed your master, Pemba. I struck him down with my own hand." He did not know what compelled him to say that.
"I know," she whispered. "Do you hate me for that, little witch?" "I praise you for that."
Her voice shook with quiet vehemence, and her hip touched his under the kaross.
"Praise? Did you not love Pemba as a dog loves its master?" "I hated him, and when I foresaw his death in the magic calabash, I was filled with joy."
"You saw his death?"
"I saw his death, as I saw your face long before you came to take me."
Butso shuddered involuntarily, and she felt it.
"You are cold, Lord."
She pressed a little closer to him. Her flesh was hot and soft. He felt his own flesh respond to its touch.
"Why did you hate Pemba?" "He was evil beyond the telling. The things he forced me to do I will never forget."
"He used your body?" There was a rough edge to Butso's question.
"Not even Pemba would dare tamper with the body of one of the chosen ones, for to tear the veil of maidenhood is to destroy the gift."
"The gift?"
"The gift of foresight, which the likes of Pemba value so highly." "What then did he force upon you?" "Dark things, midnight things, torture not of the body but of the spirit."
Now it was her turn to shudder, and she turned towards him and clung to his broad, smooth chest, hiding her face against it so that her voice was muffled and he could hardly catch her next words.
"I did not wish to be chosen. I hate and fear what still lies ahead of me if I follow that road."
"Pemba is dead."
"You do not understand. Pemba was but a little wizard. Already he had taught me almost all he knew."
"Then I would have been called by the one whose name I dare not speak aloud.
That call will still come, and I shall not be able to deny it."
"You are under my protection."
"There is only one way you can protect me, Butso, Lord."
"How?" "Make me worthless to them. Destroy this gift which is such a terrible burden."
"How?"
"As you destroyed Pemba with the stabbing spear of steel, destroy it with your great spear of flesh. Tear my veil and let this thing pass from me."
She felt him, hot and fierce, pressing against her, and her body seemed to melt and become pliant and yielding. "Ah, yes, Lord, make me as other women, so that I may feel your noble belly on mine in the nights, that I may feel your son kick in my womb and tug at my breast when I give him suck."
"All these things you will have, Tanasi." Butso's voice was hoarse with his wanting.
"When we reach Ugubuluwayo, the king will reward me and give me leave to go into the women and take a wife." "Lord, it is dangerous to wait."
"I will not rot on you like a slave girl. You will be the first and senior of all my wives."
"Lord!"
"Enough, Tanasi. Tempt me no further. For what you feel, hard though it may be, is not stone, but flesh only."
"Gorsi, you do not know the power of the wizards. Save me from them."
"I know the law and custom of Matabili, and that is all a man should know and heed." Butzo's scout came in at a dead run, the sweat snaking down his back and chest, and he shouted his report the moment he came up to the head of the column. Butzo whirled and barked three sharp orders. Immediately the column closed up, and the captives were forced to squat with a dozen warriors standing guard over them. The rest of the Matabili formed up behind Butzo, and he led them away at that gait between a trot and a run, which lifted the dust to their knees. Butzo picked his ambush with an unerring eye. He chose a place where broken ground and thick bush allowed only one passage through, and the single horseman rode into it. The long shields were suddenly all around him, fencing him in as his dun-coloured pony snorted and skittered. The rifle was halfway drawn from the leather boot at the horseman's knee, when Butzo stopped him with a shout. "Too late for that! You were dead, and the jackals feasting already. You grow careless despite all that I taught you, Henshaw." Ralph let the rifle slide back into its scabbard, and he threw up his hands, pleasure and chagrin warring on his face. "Shake any tree and a Matabili falls out of it." His voice was mock mournful, and he swung down off Tom's sturdy back and strode to meet Butzo. "I expect to see the Indunas ring on your forehead already, O mighty slayer of Mashona," he laughed as they embraced. "Soon, little hawk, very soon. But you, I thought your wagon would be heavy with ivory." "Done, little axe, already done." Ralph stepped back and looked at him. In the month since they had parted, both men had changed. In Butzo, there remained no trace of the young mine labourer who had worked his shifts in the pit and eaten Zuga Ballantyne's rations. Here was a warrior and a prince, tall and plumed and proud. Ralph was no longer the callow lad, his every action ordered by his father. Instead, he was a grown man with a jaunty lift to his chin and a self-assured set to his shoulder. Yet though his clothes were travel-worn and stained, the training of Zuga Ballantyne still showed, for they were recently washed, and his jaws had been clean-shaven that very morning. They looked at each other, and the affection between them was tempered and hardened with respect. "I shot a young buffalo cow not 2 hours ago."
"Yes," Butzo nodded. "It was the shot which brought us."
"Then I am glad of it. The buffalo meat is fat, and there is enough even for a hungry Matabili." Butzo glanced at the sun.
"Though I am in haste on the king's business, my prisoners are in need of rest. We will help you eat your buffalo, Henshaw, but in the dawn we will go on."
"Then there's much to talk about, and little time to do so." There was the pop of a trek whip, and Butzo glanced beyond Ralph's shoulder to see the oxen come plodding between the trees and the wagon lurching and wallowing behind them. "You still keep a bad company," Butzo scolded with a grin as he recognized Omfan at the head of the span and Itsatsi, the little Zulu, on the flank. "But the load you carry is welcome." From the wagon box hung the raw quarters and shoulders of the freshly butchered buffalo carcass.
"We have not tasted fresh meat since we left the king's kraal."
Ralph and Butzo sat at a separate fire, apart from their retinues, where they could talk freely. "The king agreed to buy the guns and bottles that I carried up from Kimberley," Ralph told Butzo, "and he paid me generously." He did not go on to describe to Butzo the currency in which he had been paid. He did not describe his own astonishment when Lobengula had offered him an uncut diamond, a big, bright first water stone. His surprise had immediately been tempered by conscience. He had no doubts about where that stone had come from. His conscience lasted about as long as his surprise, and he haggled with gusto, forcing up the price to 6 stones, which he had picked with an eye trained by many years on the diggings. He knew they would be worth £10,000 when he got them back to civilization. Thus, in a single stroke, he had paid for the wagon and team, his entire debt to Diamond Lil, interest and all, and was already many thousands of pounds in profit. "Then I asked Lobengula to let me hunt elephant, and he laughed and said I was too young and that the elephant would eat me up. He kept me waiting outside his kraal for 10 days.
"If he kept you such a short time, then you have found favour with the king," Butzo interrupted. Some white men have waited from the beginning of the dry season to the middle of the wet, merely for permission to take the road out of Matabililand.
10 days was long enough for me, Ralph grunted. But when I asked him in which part of his lands I was allowed to hunt, he laughed again and said, "The elephant will be in so little danger from you, little hawk, that you may go where you wish, and kill as many as are stupid or lame enough to let you." Butso chuckled delightedly.
"And how many lame, stupid elephant have you found so far, Henshaw?"
"I have 50 good tusks in the wagon already."
50?
Butso's chuckles died, and he stared at Ralph in amazement. Then he stood up and crossed to the wagon. He untied one of the straps and lifted the canvas cover to peer in at the load, while Izasi looked up from his cooking fire, frowned, and called to Ralph.
"This boy's great-grandfather Mashobani was a thief. His grandfather Mzilikatsi was a traitor. You have every reason to trust him with your ivory, Henshaw."
Butso did not look at him, but glanced up into the trees.
"The monkeys hereabouts make a frightful chatter," he murmured, and then came back to Ralph. "Fine tusks," he admitted, "like the ones the hunters took when I was still a child."
Ralph did not tell him that most of those in the wagon were taken even before that time. He had discovered all but two of the caches that his father had bequeathed to him. The ivory had dried out, lost almost a quarter of its green weight, but most of it was still in good condition and would fetch the market price once he got it to the railhead. Though Ralph had hunted diligently for his own elephant whilst he sought out Zuga's ancient dumps, he had had little success. He had killed 5, only one of which was a bull, and whose green tusks had weighed just over 60 pounds. The others had been small female ivory, barely worth taking. The great herds that Zuga had described in A Hunter's Odyssey no longer existed. Since those days there had been many hunters, some of them inspired by Zuga's own writing. Boer and Briton, Hottentot and German, they had hunted and harried the huge grey beasts and left their white bones piled on the felt and in the forest.
"Yes, they're good tusks," Ralph nodded, "and my wagon is heavy laden now. I am on the road back to the King's Kraal to ask him for permission to leave Matabililand and go to Kimberley."
"Then when you have gone, we will see you no more," Butso said quietly. "You will be like the other white men who come to Matabililand. You will take what you want and never come back."
Ralph laughed.
"No, old friend, I will be back.
I do not have everything I wish, not yet.
I will come back with more wagons, perhaps 6 wagons, all loaded with trade goods. I will set up trading posts from the Shashi River to the Zambezi."
"You will be a rich man, Henshaw, I am sure of it," Butso agreed. "But rich men are not always happy men. This I have remarked often. Is there nothing else in Matabililand for you but ivory and gold and diamonds?"
Ralph's expression changed.
"How did you know that?" he demanded.
"I asked. I did not know," Butso denied, still smiling. "Though I do not have to throw the bones or look in the magic calabash to know it is a woman. You have suddenly the look of a dog that smells the bitch. Tell me, Henshaw, who is she, and when will you take her to wife?"
Then he laughed aloud.
"You have not yet asked her father. Or you have asked and he has refused?"
"It is not a matter of for laughter," Ralph said stiffly, and with an effort Butso wiped the mirth from his face, though it twinkled still in his eyes.
"Forgive one who loves you as a brother. I did not know it was such a heavy matter."
And at last he managed to match Ralph's portentous expression, while he waited for him to speak again.
"Once, long ago, while we rode up in the skip, you spoke of a woman with hair as white and fine as the winter's grass," Ralph said at last, and Butso nodded.
"It is she, Butso. I have found her." "She wants you as much as you want her," Butso said firmly. "If she does not, then she is so stupid that she does not deserve you."
"I haven't asked her yet," Ralph admitted.
"Do not ask her. Tell her, and then ask her father. Show the father your tusks of ivory. That will settle the matter."
"You are right, Butso," Ralph looked dubious. "It will be that simple.
and then softly in English so that Butzo could not understand. God knows what I shall do if it is not. I don't think I can live without her. If he did not follow the words, Butzo understood the sense and the mood. He sighed, and his eyes strayed to Tanasi at the cooking fire. They are so soft and weak, but they wound more deeply than the sharpest steel. Ralph followed his eyes, and then suddenly his own expression cleared, and it was his turn to guffaw and reach across to slap Butzo's shoulder. Now I recognize the look you spoke of earlier, the dog with the smell of the bitch in his nostrils. It is not a matter for laughter, said Butzo haughtily. Long after the last gnawed buffalo bone was thrown upon the fire and the last beer pot emptied, long after the Matabele warriors had tired of singing the song of Pemba, the ode to their own prowess and courage on the hill of the wizard, and rolled into their sleeping carouses, long after the last captive girl had ceased wailing, Butzo and Ralph sat on beside their own fire, and the drone of their voices and the munch of the oxen chewing the cud were the only sounds in the camp. It was as though every last moment was precious to them, for both sensed that when they met again, they would be changed, and perhaps the world with them. They relived their youth, remembering Scipio the falcon, and Inkosikasi the great spider. They smiled at the stinging memory of the fighting sticks and Bakela's wrath when Butzo gave him the shattered diamond. They talked of Jordan and Yan Shirut, and Kamuza and all the others, until at last, reluctantly, Butzo rose. I will be gone before the sun, Henshaw, he said. Go in peace, Butzo, and enjoy the honours that await you and the woman you have won. When Butzo reached his sleeping mat, the girl was already wrapped in his kaross. As soon as Butzo lay down beside her, she reached for him. She was as hot as though she was in high fever, her body burning and her skin dry. Silent sobs racked her, and her grip was fierce. What is it, Tanasi? He was shocked and alarmed. A vision, a terrible vision. A dream, he was relieved. It was only a dream. It was a vision, she denied. Oh, Butzo, will you not take this terrible gift from me before it destroys us both? He held her and could not answer her. Her distress moved him deeply, but he was helpless to alleviate it. After a while she was quiet, and he thought that she slept. But then suddenly she whispered, "It was a terrible vision, Butzo Lord, and it will haunt me unto my grave." He did not answer, but he felt the superstitious chill in his guts. "I saw you high upon a tree." She broke off, and another single sob hit her like a blow. "The white man, the one you call Henshaw the Hawk. Do not trust him. He is my brother, and like a brother I love him." Then why did he not weep, Butzo? Why did he not weep when he looked up at you upon the tree? Selina Codrington rolled out her pastry with long and expert strokes of the pin. The sleeves of her blouse were rolled high, and she was floury to the elbows. Little blobs of pastry stuck to her hands and fingers. The thatched ceiling of the kitchen at Kami Mission Station was sooty from the open iron stove, and the smell of the dough was yeasty and warm. A single skein of white gold hair had escaped the ribbon, and now tickled her nose and chin. Selina pursed her lips and blew it away. It floated like gossamer, and then gently settled across her face again, but she did not change the rhythm of the rolling pin. Ralph thought that little gesture the most poignant he had ever witnessed, but then everything she did fascinated him, even the way she cocked her head and smiled at him as he slouched against the jamb of the kitchen door.